because we're going to talk about enterprise networking with Link 2013. So I think this is fun material. It is, however, so we'll do a general introduction first, and then we'll do a deep dive into networking requirements and bandwidth requirements, which will, so half of the audience will start to hate me, and the other half will think, oh, thank you for explaining. It's always a bit of a trade-off. So I have to ask you once again, please complete your evaluations. We built a fantastic mobile app for that. That doesn't work right now. So you can not use that. Please go to the schedule builder and you can complete your evaluations, because we schedule people and sessions based on your feedback. And if you like stuff, we'll do more of it. If you dislike stuff, we'll do less of it. So yes, you control conferences like these. What are we going to talk about today? We're going to talk about, to help you have a better understanding of quality of service. It's not just Link that uses quality of service. It's a wide, it's a commonly used concept. It's not a technology, it's a concept, quality of service. And we're going to talk about that and explain that to you. And we'll talk about Link 2013 bandwidth requirements. Now, before I move on, do we have people in the room that call themselves network engineers? Oh, a couple of people. So you can yell at me if you think I'm wrong. I'm very happy to do that. Because this is me. So I'm Cornel Bullens. I'm from the Netherlands. I live in Houten, which is close to Utrecht, the middle of the Netherlands. I used a very Dutch picture for this. So we have sort of an open sky with a lot of clouds, and we have bikes, and we have bike lanes. And as you can see, we don't have any cars in this picture, because in the town I live in, we hate cars. Actually, so I live sort of to the right of that picture, and there's like a there's a big grocery store on the left. If I walk there, it's going to take me 3 minutes, literally 3 minutes. If I take my car, it's 25 minutes, because we hate cars in my village. It's fantastic. So I only get very small groceries. Anyway, if you want to bug me, kbunnens@microsoft.com, you can IM me, you can call me, you can send me emails. I work for the Microsoft Consultancy Services Enterprise Global Communications Practice. And yes, I practice that. I joined Microsoft in 2011. I came from a local Dutch partner. I have a background in networking. I used to be with Dimension Data, then a local, a different Microsoft partner. Within the global practice, my main focuses are around networking and enterprise voice telephony. Let's see, what else? I used to teach at our Microsoft Certified Master and Certified Solution Master program, and then we killed that off. So that is some of my background. And I like LEGO Ultimate Collector Sets. So if you have LEGO Star Wars Ultimate Collector Sets, or if you have this very special Batman one, I want that one too. So there's my address is there. Some of the defects that I have, and I'm well aware of them, I tend to move around a lot, as you might have seen already. I am Dutch, and I speak English rather quickly, and I speak it in my own little Dutch way. So you might not recognize some of the words I use, because those are probably made-up words, and I completely understand that. So if I talk too quickly for you, or if I said something that is not a real word, let me know, and I'll be happy to get back to that and then talk again about it, and now using actual words. So for today, we'll do a little introduction about networking. We'll talk about QoS basics. And then we're going to overlay the QoS basics on Link 2013, how does Link use QoS, and how can Link adhere to your or your customer's QoS strategy. And we will conclude today's session with a headache causer, namely the network bandwidth requirements for Link 2013, and specifically video. I see people shaking because it is very difficult. And we are very well aware. So let's start off with an introduction about network. So why do we care about network planning? Well, the network is the plumbing of Link. That's as simple as it gets. Does it really matter for IM? No. IM will sort of always work, even if you have a very bad network. It'll just work. Audio and video, not so much. And that's crucial to us, because if we're doing things like PBX replacements, if my phone worked yesterday, and I had this very old hard phone, and I moved to Link, which is a better system, and you've sold this to your user, or your IT department has sold this to you as being a way better system, and you make a call, and it sounds terrible, you did not get a better system. You got a worse system. And at that point, your end users, they don't care about the network. And they shouldn't. It should just work. Which means we have a very important job for us, which is making sure the network is able to support Link. And it's a joint partnership. The networking team wants to know a lot of stuff about Link. Link wants to know a lot about, the Link team wants to know a lot of stuff about the network, and we have to work together to make sure we get the best sort of performance out of both systems. Worst thing is, if we look at Premier support cases, up to 85% of support cases are related to networking issues. Out of those, 48% are related to networking, as in misconfigured networks. So it's a network not supporting Link in the manner it should. And that's a whole lot of issues. 48% of Link voice support cases. And just look at things like load balancer stuff, all kinds of stuff. It's all having an impact on the network. And the way we've configured and we've talked to the networking team, this is how you should configure your network. So when we look at those networking issues and when we look at how the network should be configured, we need to understand why do we need good performance from the network. And it's basically around these three central values for us: latency, jitter, and packet loss. So first of all, what's latency? Latency is basically the time it takes from a packet to go from A to B. Do we have a lot of control over that? Well, up to a certain point, we have certain laws, like the speed of light, and you can't really go quicker than that. And for the people that think they can, come and talk to me yesterday. See, nerdy joke. Oh, it's too bad, too bad. We have certain restrictions in things like speed of light, other laws of physics that tell us, well, a packet takes a certain amount of time to get from, for instance, Barcelona up to Sydney. So it does say, well, if I travel over my network from Barcelona to Madrid, and if I get 150 milliseconds of delay, that's probably not a very good number. Do I get 150 milliseconds from Barcelona to Sydney? Yeah, I'm pretty happy. So it's all been put in perspective, right? It's the time between A and B. Jitter. Jitter is the value that we need. It's sort of our buffer. You see things like jitter buffer in our QE reporting. It's basically a little time frame we need to reorganize our packets. So even though we put our packets on the line, as in first packet 1, then 2, then 3, then 4, they never really arrive in that manner. So we need a little buffer, we need a little time to put them back into 1, 2, 3, 4, and that's our jitter. Then lastly, packet loss, which can either be caused by packets not getting there or by deformed packets. It's the percentage of packets that are actually unusable to Link. Within Link, we use UDP as our primary transport protocol when it comes to things like audio and video. It's a fire forget mechanism. So we send audio and we hope it arrives. We do the same for video. For SIP, for desktop sharing, all the other goodness, we use TCP. And the reason behind that is for UDP, in all honesty, the packets are so small. If I lose some packets along the line, using TCP, we could have retransmitted them. If I get a packet, let's say I have 10 packets in 1 second, and I get 1 second of voice. And now my machine knows, well, I missed the first 1/10 of a second, and I do a retransmit. Is that usable?
Not really.
I don't care about that packet anymore. So we don't need TCP for audio and video. We always use UDP. Because we can just send it, and if we don't get it, we use some healing mechanisms to sort of make it audible again, and the packets are a little bit smaller than 1/10 of a second, but that's the general idea behind it, right? Audio and video, UDP, send and forget, all the other goodness, TCP. Because if a SIP message, if an IM, takes a couple of milliseconds longer to get there, and but it gets there in one piece, oh, that's fantastic. We like getting complete IM messages. So there's latency, jitter, and packet loss. Well, do they affect just audio and video? No. It's very annoying if you get this lines, a little circular thingy in front of your SIP message, that it takes so long for the message to get there. Is it a life-threatening issue? Not really. It can affect other things. If I got 80% packet loss, that's a lot. My IM message won't really work well, but they'll still work. It can affect other things, specifically desktop sharing is very it's very highly impacted by things like packet loss. In general, we mostly look in audio and video when it comes to quality degradation. So what do we do about that? We have a mechanism called quality of service. So first of all, what is quality of service? Quality of service is it's basically a collection of networking technologies that we can use to improve getting a packet from A to B in the best way possible. So when do we need this? So in our networking guide, when we talk about QoS, we need this. It's commonly used when network bandwidth is limited. The good thing is, no one has unlimited bandwidth, so it's actually almost always used. So when would we recommend it? And when we say you now really need it, if there's a possibility of network congestion. And once again, if you have people on your network, there's always a risk of congestion. So I remember the OCS 2007 launch where Gurdeep went on stage and he got a question about QoS, and he basically said, oh, we don't need QoS, we do magic stuff. There are magic codecs in Link. Well, that's not entirely true. We need QoS. Link is a system like any other that uses real-time audio and video. And our suggestion and our best practice is always deploy QoS. It's exactly for the two reasons that are listed here. QoS improves your end-to-end user experience from the networking perspective. And if the network's good and the packets get there on time, the audio experience and the video experience will be good. So QoS is the end-to-end thing. QoS starts on the user's machine and it ends on the target user's machine. It's not something for your backbone network. It's end-to-end. It will help you route those traffic flows. And yeah, there are situations where you simply cannot do QoS. And we'll cover those in this presentation as well. But it is something not just for a very limited portion of your network. It is an end-to-end thing. So when we started off with OCS, so that's the beauty. If you work for a company that builds something like OCS and then Link, you deploy it yourselves, right? And when we deployed it ourselves, using the words of our benevolent leader, Mr. Gurdeep Singh Pal, we didn't use QoS. We did not get such a great experience. Our Microsoft IT, when they deployed Link 2010 and upwards, they went back and took a look at our network. They started deploying QoS. We wrote a very nice white paper about that, because what's nicer than deploying enterprise voice in 100,000 plus seat deployment? And we actually have gotten all the settings we used and all the tricks we did, we put that in our white paper. By the way, the letters are ridiculously small on the, well, they're much larger on the large screen, I realize that. you can take pictures of this. We also have all the presentations available for download from either Channel 9 or the TechEd site. And you can click on the links, very convenient. So if you want to visit these links, download the presentation afterwards and you can go there. Anyway, what we've seen in actually most of our issues was that QoS was sort of deployed, but the way Microsoft works, we have a lot of different subsidiaries. So in the US, we used methodology A, and in the Netherlands, we used B, and in Germany, we used C, and they weren't always compatible. And the nice thing is when network equipment fights, the local equipment always wins. So some of the voice traffic that came on the line as being very high priority in the US turned out to be in some trash queue in Europe and then the other way around. So one of the first things they did is actually do a complete networking audit and check out, well, what have we actually got configured? And if we replace stuff, do we copy the old settings or do we just assume this is how it should be configured? And you would be surprised how many times when network equipment gets replaced, they use something like an initial config and they put it on there because that's the initial config of that was used when the hardware was installed. And if we make changes later on, well, who needs documentation? So we saw a huge drift in configuration over our networking equipment that caused us so many issues. Anyway, interesting read. So let's take a quick look at the QoS mechanisms that we have. So QoS all boils down to, depending on the type of traffic, we need to treat it differently. And a different treatment means a different QoS mechanism. So the most commonly used is queuing. We also have some traffic shaping. We also have things like congestion avoidance if you have multiple paths. Queuing is the most commonly used. So how can we distinguish that traffic? So the first thing everybody will tell you, we'll do deep packet inspection. Deep packet inspection is fun if you have 5 users. As soon as you get into the 1,000 plus users, and you've got things like 50 or 60 Mbit of link traffic doing deep packet inspection over encrypted traffic, certainly possible. The price for that is also quite impossible. Let me just put it that way. So it's a nice concept, never really usable. So the most commonly ways of doing that is port actually looking at different ports of the traffic, VLAN IDs, 802.1p. We have DiffServe, which is the one that we recommend, or even MPLS tags. So how does QoS actually look like in a graphical representation? So your gray portion of this graphic is the issue network bandwidth. Like 100 Mbits. Now, how do we class that? So we've got the top queue, in this case, expedited forwarding. Low latency, low jitter, low loss. It basically means everything that gets put in here needs to go somewhere else pronto. For media streaming, we use assured forwarding, such as video. It is low latency, low jitter, try not to lose too much. And then we've got AF1, bulk data transfer, and we've got default classes. But this is basically how a normal connection would be classified in different queues. The higher, the less loss, the less jitter, the less delay. So how do we put things in these queues? So we've got our layer 2 mechanisms. So in ye olden days, we used VLAN priorities. You had a voice VLAN, and you had a video VLAN, and you'd put stuff in those VLANs. You'd basically say, if stuff's in this VLAN, make it snappy. That's sort of a challenge when you've got a laptop with a soft client. My laptop doesn't have different networking ports, so now I need to either do trunking or goodliness like that, which is even more fun on wireless. So concept's great. not really usable right now. Same with 802.1p marking. It's all layer 2 stuff. So as soon as you go outside of an IP subnet, you're done. So what do we use? So we have a port-based method, which is basically looking at, oh, if stuff's coming from this port, it's probably audio. It's probably video, things like that. Link fully supports that. So you can set up port ranges for Link. The thing we like, because it's uniform, it always works, and it's always there on the traffic, how far it travels. However far it travels, is a DSCP marking. So basically the soft client marks traffic with this should be considered as expedited forwarding traffic. This should be considered as assured forwarding. Small little drawback. There is always this user in your company that really dislikes his BitTorrent and downloads to go a bit slowly. So he downloads this program for the internet to start tagging all of his traffic with expedited forwarding. That kind of sucks. So while we love this as Link admins, as networking admins, you don't really love this because the PC is an untrusted device. Now, we have some solutions for that. But what we usually see is a combination of the two. So grudgingly, we'll allow DSCP markings on the PC, but we'll combine that with a port range. So you get some access control lists in your router saying, well, if traffic's coming from this port range, with these taggings, you can leave the taggings on. If it's not from that port range, strip all taggings. That usually gets I want to say appreciated, probably not the right word, that gets some agreement from both the networking and the Link team. And it's very reliable. That's usually the way we recommend and we see our deployments. A combination of port-based tagging and DSCP tagging. So what happens in our routers? So this is the easy picture. We put traffic in. So I had to sort of clean up my deck. I used to have like this portal from the game portal. I had this diagram saying speedy thing in, speedy thing out. Which is sort of the thing that happens with QS. So EF is a speedy thing, and we want to keep it as a speedy thing. So if you look at the one on the left is sort of a big lot of queue diagram. I like the one on the right that has a priority queue and a queue 2, 3, and 4. So traffic comes in, there's a little mechanism in your router that classifies traffic. So we can see some red traffic, some blue traffic. It comes in, it gets classified, then put in the correct queue, and we'll go from top to bottom. So we'll make sure Q1's empty before we start processing Q2. We'll make sure Q1 and 2 are empty before we do Q3. We'll make sure 1, 2, and 3 are empty before we do 4, et cetera, et cetera. That's how usually routers handle things like expedite forwarding, assured forwarding, things like that. And I understand this is a simplification of things, but in essence, this is how you can consider QoS and queuing to work. One of the things, if we look at the previous picture here, you can see the different sizes of our pipes. That's not just for graphical, so because I had some room to spare. That's actually the way it works, because you pay for different quality of lines, especially in MPLS clouds. So you've got things like a diamond, a platinum, a gold class, and they map to EF or AF or different QS mechanisms. So you usually have something like, so our recommendation is get 30% of your bandwidth for real-time communication traffic. Usually about 15% is video, 15% is audio. Now, what would happen if I had 10 Mbit of traffic reserved for expedite forwarding, but I actually put 11 Mbit of traffic on there? So this is something that we never really consider. It is very important because depending on your customer, they might treat it differently. So if I have a queue overflow, I put more traffic in my queue than my queue actually can handle, two things can happen. First, it can go into a lower class queue. So in this case, it could go from EF to AF4, or it could be dropped. Those are two very valid approaches. But the thing you need to remember is that if I, let's say my queue is large enough for 10 calls, but I actually put 11 calls on it, and we either put it in a lower class queue or we drop traffic, how many calls would be affected? Who thinks one? Who thinks 11? Very good. All calls will be affected. It's not like a little water bucket where the first 10 calls are safe. No, everything's accepted. Every call will get in trouble now. Very important concept. Very important to think about this when talking to your customers. This is why we introduced things like call admission control. It's not to bug users. It's to make sure we don't start dropping traffic. We don't affect every call in our queue. So this is the complicated picture. It uses the old CS system. This is the mapping of QoS. So for those interested, it's a fun picture. I try to ignore it because if I don't see it, it's not there. QoS can get complicated quickly. One of the things we always tell people, and this is my prime example, of different companies, well, different buildings and different subsidiaries doing different things. So if I have a main campus and a remote site, although I have my five different queues, my five different 802.1p values, so I've got a CS6, 5, 4, 0, and 1 selector, I only have three in my remote site. So the impact of this is while I put signaling in my class 4, tag it with DSCP 26. In my remote site, SIP now has the same priority as video. I never checked that. This is something you need to take into account. This is something you need to talk to your networking team and see, just because something works in site A, how is site B configured? We've seen this so many times. So what about QoS and Link 2013? How does Link 2013 use this QoS values? So the easiest way of doing this is DSCP tagging. We have some mechanisms in there to help with rogue traffic tagging. So if it's a domain joint PC, you can use the link policy. You can use the domain group policies, and you can actually specify in your GPO that DSCP tagging is to be used, and which programs are allowed to do DSCP tagging. So in this example, I actually use DSCP tagging 46, and I'm specifying that link.exe is allowed to do DSCP tagging. Nice thing about this, as soon as this policy is activated and my machine starts doing DSCP tagging, my networking scheduler, it will take a look at all traffic. It will tell you, oh, wait a second, this is also tagged. This has not been done by link.exe. Strip it. So this is one of the methods to guard against rogue DSCP tagging. It does require a GPO, so it doesn't work on bring your own device. This is also for the link client, the link desktop client. I've included some links here on how to enable QoS tagging, how to enable the DSCP tagging in Link 2013. Both the white papers as well as a blog by Alan Chutnow on how to do this. So this is the Link desktop client. We've got way more clients than just a desktop client. We've got a mobile client. We've got IP phones. We've got SIP trunks. We have got internet-based link clients. How do you handle those for QoS? Well, some of them are fairly easy to do, like servers. How do we handle our servers? Well, I'm hoping that users are not working on your server, so you have less chance of rogue DSCP tagging. So that's sort of an easy thing, and we can use port ranges as well. Link IP phones, we can push a policy down to the IP phone to set up EF tagging for all media traffic from the IP phones. SIP trunking, we've got some guidance on how to configure SBCs and other gateways. And the nice thing about internet-based link clients, the internet doesn't adhere to QoS tagging, so easy solution, you don't have to do it. So the ever upcoming discussion about which values should I use, whatever you want. It's very simple. Whatever you want to do, it's all good. We recommend using expedited forwarding, DCP point value 46, for voice. We recommend video for 34. Why? Mainly, it's how we do it. It's how we do it, how we've seen our tests, the best results. If you use a different value, you're absolutely not wrong. Use the values you get the best mileage from. These work best for us. The one little strange thing here is SIP signaling to use tagging 24. We've had some discussions about that. I always get into questions and with customers about, well, we need to tag SIP traffic. No, you don't. It's not wrong if you want to do it. You don't. But we're doing it right now. Well, that's correct, because you're using a VoIP class PBX, which uses UDP for SIP signaling. And for some reason, we really want our signaling to work, or else your calls go to hell. So with UDP, yeah, I would probably tag that traffic too. We use TCP for SIP. So if the packet doesn't arrive, we'll do a retransmit. And that's so quick that, well, if I hang up now or a couple of milliseconds later, it's a potato story. Is it wrong? No. Do we recommend it? No. It's not necessary. The one thing we always want to point out, if you have an existing PBX or an existing video solution in there, and you've configured this is now using 80% of your queues, and you introduce link, and you use the same QoS values, this might put your queue out of its limits. So usually at a customer, and most customer sites, you'll have a networking team, you'll have a video team, you'll have a telephony team, you'll have a link team, and they don't necessarily talk to each other. Which means that the video team might be happy about having filled 80% of its queue, but they never really told anyone, and the networking team doesn't necessarily have insight on actual usage of bandwidth, and you've just told your link team that they could actually use 10 Mbit for video. Well, they couldn't because 80% is used, and now everything goes to hell. When we implement link, and especially when we implement networking things with link, we need to talk to everybody that's doing stuff on or to the network. Very important. The other very important thing to do is to validate. Trust is good. Checking up on things is way better. We have seen, so I work for Microsoft Consulting Services. We have an offering that we do with partners quite a bit. It's called the Link Network Assessment, where we validate end-to-end QoS and we validate how a network handles traffic, link traffic. I have never been to a customer where everything worked the way the customer told me it was working. I have been to customers where they were paying for over 5 years for a diamond class MPLS cloud. And their monthly bill was more than five numbers. So they were not paying a little bit, right? Turned out that the provider actually forgot to enable it. So they paid for it for 4 or 5 years. Never really got it. They got some money back. It's things like this, just because it's in the end, we're all humans, and we have to configure stuff, and everybody makes mistakes. So check if something's been configured. You can use Netmon for that. There's a nice blog on that. We wrote one to help you check that. You can use Netmon to see, is my traffic leaving my client being tagged with DHCP? And you can then use the same netmon netmon on the receiving client to see, okay, do I actually still have the DSCP tagging? If it's changed or if it's gone, something happened along the way. Some of the indicators for that is things like average packet loss rate. 20.9% average packet loss rate is not good. When we talk about network, we usually talk about managed and unmanaged networks. Managed networks are networks where QoS is enabled. Unmanaged is the internet. On an unmanaged network, I expect there to be 0% packet loss. If you have a managed network and you have more than 0% packet loss, I would like an explanation. An explanation like that network sucks is a fantastic explanation, but it's an explanation. If your networking team says, we didn't know about that, that's not an explanation and requires investigation. We have some values of what we like network packet loss to be. So we'd like packet loss to be below 3%. We like jitter to be below 15%. We like our end-to-end delay from a networking level to be below 150 milliseconds. That doesn't mean that on a connection between Barcelona and Madrid, 3% packet loss, 50 milliseconds of jitter, and 150 milliseconds of delay on a managed network is a good thing. Yes, it's within our limits. It's not good. So some of the network bandwidth estimation, we have a fantastic tool. So we have the link network, the link bandwidth calculator. It's maintained by my dearest colleague, Mr. Marius Ostrowski, a very nice Polish guy who is always at Tech at Russia. So if you ever want to go to Tech at a medium, go to Tech at Russia. So he builds and writes the bandwidth calculator. It will help you determine the amount of bandwidth to be used. We have some. We also have a network planning and troubleshooting guide that some of my colleagues and I wrote on how to basically build your network for Link. The very important point here is that you can't do any planning without knowing what's going to happen to your network. And that's why we built a bandwidth calculator. The one feedback we always get from customers is, well, that's fantastic, but how does link traffic flow? Where does this traffic go? Is it peer-to-peer? Is it going to the server and back? Is it just doing whatever it wants? How does this work? And how much is it? So that's what we're going to talk about now. So first of all, we have some link server-to-server traffic. Like intra-pool and SQL backend traffic, it's all over the LAN. And we've got some traffic between the link pools, which is our SIP signaling, our data replication. This is all generated by the link servers. We also have those pesky little things called users, and they actually want to use our product. And they generate traffic too. They generate signaling, SIP signaling. They generate media, audio and video. And they generate content, PowerPoints, desktop sharing. So what kind of user-generated traffic do we get? SIP signaling, in-SIP messaging, peer-to-peer audio and video, multi-party audio, multi-party video, PSTN audio, and desktop and application sharing. This is a significant portion of traffic. And the good thing about it is, it's predictable. We kind of know how many people will make calls on an average basis. We can build quite simple user models. They're all in the bandwidth calculator. And we sort of know if there's a data sharing session, we kind of know how much traffic that will generate. We know that an average user will not be in a call all day long. Unfortunately, there are also some traffic flows that we cannot really estimate. We don't know how large your PowerPoints will be. We don't know if your IT department likes sharing complete ISOs over file transfer. Perhaps you're presenting to customers on a regular basis, and you always attach your complete UC portfolio, which is 300 max, to every presentation you do. We don't know that. Persistent chat, the big unknown. I don't. If you notice traffic, you can certainly calculate for that. It's an unknown to us. It's very hard to predict. If you have numbers for that, you can input them in the bandwidth calculator. We have no guidelines for that, unfortunately. So our codecs, Link, Arch Audio, G722. So the new one here is G722/2. It's the only codec we use for a Link room system. So unless you have a Link room system, you will never see it. And which codec is not on the list, but is actually in the client? No one? This is the interactive portion. Which codec is in the client, but not on the list? Silk, there we go. Do we use Silk in peer-to-peer between Link? Yes, no, yes, no. It's a 50% chance. Yes. Wrong, no. You see 50% chance, 50% chance. No, so Link is peer-to-peer audio, so we... Yes, there's also the Silk codec. We didn't include it here. We didn't include it in our bandwidth calculator because it's only used when you place a call between a Link and a Skype client. It's an interop thing. It's not used. It's RT Audio, our primary codec. Exchange Unified Messaging can do G711, RT Audio, G723. So this is the set of parameters that we have when we start calculating bandwidth. Bandwidth profiles, so this is typical traffic. we give you typical bandwidth, we give you upper bandwidth with forward error correction, and we give you upper bandwidth without forward error correction. So from these three values, when I'm calculating expected bandwidth, I'm using typical values. Why? Well, it's a huge... Usually, you're calculating bandwidth for more than one user. It's the law of big numbers, so you can do well with average numbers. As soon as I go into what's the maximum amount of bandwidth I can expect, if this is a managed network, I don't expect forward error correction to kick in, so I'll use my upper limit. If this is an unmanaged network, I would use, and my customer would ask me, how much traffic could Link generate? I would say, well, I expect it to be, for instance, for RT Audio wideband, I expect it to be around 40 kilobits. But if stuff goes wrong, and this is over the internet, I could go up to 91 kilobits. Yes? That's a good question. And I don't have the answer for that here. We will put out guidance once we start widely using it. Is that sort of answering the question? Yeah, that's a good question. So it's not included yet. Since our enterprise customers wouldn't really be using that internally, so we wouldn't really have to plan for that. It's coming. We will put the guidance out there. So that's the bandwidth profiles. That's why we put three different values for the same thing. That's why we put three different values for RT Audio, for Siren, for G711. They're all from TechNet. So what's the... And this is a little tidbit of information because you see this in your QE reporting, your packetization time. What does that mean? So RT Audio, dynamic codec, so we can change packetization times. We have a portion that's called packet overhead, and we've got audio in there. So if you look at 20 milliseconds of RT audio, actually half of that is overhead, the other half is the actual audio. Are we now on a very reliable network? We can put more audio in a packet. We use less bandwidth. And the amount of bandwidth we used is actually very significant. So using 60 kilobits for 20 milliseconds of audio on the left, up to 60 milliseconds with only 40 kbps, so we're using three times the amount of audio, we're transporting 3 times the amount of audio than in the initial picture, but we're actually using 20-30% less bandwidth. So why don't we do this all the time? Well, we add delay because we have to wait for the complete packet to arrive. Also, if this packet gets lost along the way, that hurts us 3 times as badly as the beginning packet. So that's the difference you'll see in packetization time. That's why you can see the actual bandwidth usage varying, because we have something called RTCP, real-time control protocol, that's running next to the RTC channel, the real-time communication channel. And that RTCP channel makes sure that it tests the bandwidth, tests the connection, and based on the outcome of what the quality of network is, we can change packetization time for dynamic codecs such as RT audio. G711 in that instance is very easy for us because it's not dynamic, so it's always the same. RT audio has the advantage of moving around, which is exactly why you might start off a call with acceptable quality, and the quality gets better or maybe even worse, because we can shift around with the dynamic codecs until we find the exact right match for you. So Link 2013, the actual bandwidth calculations. So what did we change in 2013? What do we change in traffic flows between 2013 and 2010? I'm going to show you what the video flows like, because that's the real thing we changed, and how do we model this kind of traffic. So first of all, what are the changes? Well, not much. SIP signaling, IM presence, peer-to-peer audio, multi-party audio, PSTN audio, desktop application sharing, it's exactly the same. Yes, we introduced a new codec in Link 2013 for Link Room System. How many of you have deployed a Link Room System internally? See, one, two, couple of people. Is every call you make including a Link Room System? No. Is every conference including a Link Room System? No. I hope a lot of them are. It's a nice system. But it doesn't really impact bandwidth all that much. But we changed something quite dramatically. We changed video. So first of all, we switched to H.264. We took away some of the server transcoding. We use SVC, which is a scalable video codec, which makes sure we can use something called temporal scalability. And for those unfamiliar with what temporal scalability is, what it allows us to do. So previously in Link 2010, we needed to have like AV pools because audio video was very resource intensive. We thought it was kind of a bum deal because we wanted to expand, we wanted to do Link Online, we wanted to do way more stuff. And for some reason, when we told the Link Online team, well, if you want to do like big meetings in the cloud, oh, by the way, we're going to use up half of Azure for all the transcoding, they were not happy. So what we said, oh, maybe if we switch codecs and we use a better codec, we can sort of do away with that. So with temporal scalability, what you can do is you can start dropping frames very easily. So instead of doing 30 frames per second, you can switch to 15 frames per second, which uses roughly 30 to 40% less traffic. In a conference, we've seen most conference, people aren't looking directly at the video. People are looking at the content, and video is a nice bonus. So dropping from 30 to 15 frames in all of our user testing, no one actually noticed. So that's one of the things we do to save bandwidth. We still have RT video. It's still there. If you have a Link 2010 client joining a meeting, RT video is used. We often get asked, which resolutions do you support? I think the correct answer is a boatload. Almost every resolution you can think of can be encoded using the H.264 codec. There is no, I believe we have a list that's like so long that has all kinds of different sizes. They're not very relevant, and I'll show you why. One of the other changes that's there is we now have multi-view. So we can have multiple people in a presentation or in a conference all sharing video. This is the point where all network admins yell at me, telling me there's no way this is gonna happen, because you'll be using so much bandwidth. We don't have this. It's silly. You're using way too much bandwidth. You should do you should be using multicasting and stuff like that. It's silly what you do. And then we talk about how it actually works, and then we're all friends again. Short summary of what's happening now, and this is. So there is a reason. I don't want to cause you a headache, because now we're going to do difficult stuff. We're going to talk about how Link 2013 handles video. For those needing to catch a plane or are generally bored with my presentation so far, the only thing I want you to remember is it actually uses less bandwidth than compared to 2010. Even if you have 5 simultaneous videos in your presentation, it will use less bandwidth. That's the summary of it. Now let's start talking about headaches. So, peer-to-peer, easy. We will send either 4-3 or 16-9, and the actual amount of video we'll be sending depends on the receiver. So, usually it's 360p. That's the usual resolution, because that's my default size. If someone calls me over video, it's 360p, fine. If I enlarge my window, depending on the size of my video screen, I will do a request to my sender and tell them, I changed my video screen, I want a higher resolution. See, someone's leaving, and I told him, nothing's changed as far as bandwidth perspective, and that's why I told that. depending on the size of the video screen of the receiver, the sender changes the video of the size of the video stream he's sending. So, do we support full HD video? Yes. Does that mean every call will have full HD video? Not by far. Because in general, to be honest, so I'm part of a global practice, so my manager is in Ireland, and my director is in Germany, I believe. It's always, my main boss is somewhere in Redmond. When I'm on calls, I'm on video calls, do I want to see them in full screen? No, because it really interferes with my Facebooking. So it's on the side, it does. I don't know how you do calls with managers, but they say a lot of stuff, and half of them, I feel, doesn't really apply to me, so I do different stuff. But I don't want his face full HD on my screen. I've got better things to do. So most of the video calls, and I dare to say almost all of the video calls, will be in my 320p or smaller resolution. So sure, we can do full HD. Realistically, we will almost never use it. Also, depending on the receiving window, it will be 4-3 or 16-9 resolution. We can also do a panorama view. So Polycom has the new HX5000, which is the new and improved roundtable, which has full HD panoramic view, actual working microphones, which is also nice. But you can add a panorama view to that. The nice thing is, H.264, there is almost no device in the world that doesn't do hardware acceleration of H.264, thanks to piracy, I believe. It's a very low CPU using codec. It'll work, and you can do full HD video without the 8 gigs of internal memory requirement and 4 cores and things like that. It'll just work. So it's possible, almost never happens. Typically, 460 kilobit of traffic. And I believe with 2010, it was around 700. So why typically? Because, as I told, Facebooking manager. Yes, we can go up to 4 Mbit. Yes, network teams will freak out because every video call can take up to 4 Mbit. Won't happen. It won't happen. And there's a little real-time control protocol for 10 kilobits. Now, should we use a 2010 client, we'll both talk RT, we'll use RT video, VC1. Now, we talked about this, screen size impacts video. You can see the left and the right. So this is a 424 by 240 video. And on the right, we've made the video screen bigger. So now it's a 960 by 540. On the left, it's 56 kilobits. On the right, it's 168 kilobits, just by enlarging or making my video screen larger. What happens if stuff goes wrong in my network? We will, so we can try to re-request a video stream, telling them, well, I know you really want a 1080p. Let's try to do 960p. Let's try to 720p. Let's try to do a bit less and see if we still get, if we get decent quality, but now, with respect to network conditions. This is a re-request using RTCP to the other client. This is not the server transcoding, because the server transcoding wouldn't help us at all with bandwidth, because we would still have that full HD video to the server and then the smaller amount of video from the server back to the client. Now we can just do peer-to-peer, less video. The other thing, so as soon as we move into video conferencing, our traffic flow now flows between our clients and our server. So if I have a call with three people sending video, I will have from my client, by default, if everything's default, one video stream going to the server, two video streams coming back to me from the other two people. Now, all my video streams will be 16 to 9. We will not do 4 to 3. Why do we do this? Because we have a great feature called head tracking. If you ever, so I move around a lot. And if I'm in a chair, it's not much better because I can move my chair around. So I don't know if you've ever noticed, but if you're sitting in front of your PC and you're doing a link video call and you move to the left, the window shifts to the left and the camera sort of tracks you without moving. It's magic. That's because we take a 4 out of 3 portion out of that 16 to 9. Now here's the cool demo thing. If you ever want to demo the cool thing in Link, Link is very smart. So if there are two people in the same video window, we'll actually go from 4 to 3 to 16 to 9 because there are two people in the window. It's fantastic. And it's smart. I try to use a doll to sort of fake it, and it doesn't fall for that. It needs an actual person. So we by default, 16 to 9, we clip it to a tile, and we can expand that if there are multiple people in the video window. It's very cool. By default, and that's the that's the interesting thing, so you can see the branch side 1, I send it to my central side, my AV MCU, they send out my stream to the other two servers. Same thing for branch side 2, same thing for branch side 3. Right, so I've got three different video streams, and I've got six video streams coming out. See, now the picture got difficult. We can have up to 5 active video tiles, which means 5 streams coming into the AV MCU, and we've got, I want to say 15, but I know that's wrong. Oh, that's right. We can have up to 6 video streams going into the MCU because you don't see your own. And you'd have, per branch size, you'd have 5 back. So depending on the amount of clients that are into the meeting, they'll get 5 video streams in plus the previous speaker. See, it's getting ridiculously difficult. So that's why I'm going to give you a trick later on. Because we don't only send the active speaker, we also sent the previous speaker. We sort of want to keep them warm on the server, because chances are, if I just spoke and someone else is taking over and I'm now out of the 5 when out of the five active speakers, I will say something again. Most meetings, however, two, three people, five is rarely, very uncommon, happens one every 20 or 30 meetings. So we usually think about two meetings. All three video streams can be 1080p. Would that ever happen? No. It's fairly impossible, because you need more than a 4K screen for that. Because we look at the screen real estate that you have, and to get five 1080p videos, you will need a screen that can actually house five 1080p videos. If you got such a screen, I can give you my address, you can send me one, and I'd be very happy to take it off your hands. It's not happening. So what we see is that the typical video size is 240p in a meeting. Now, meetings are usually, at least the meetings I always get dragged into, are more than just looking at each other's faces. So we share something, and as soon as we share stuff, the screen estate becomes even smaller, so now we go up to 1080p. So those are really small video sizes. Thing to remember here, I send out one video stream, I get in multiple video streams. Should we have networking issues, we can use temporal scalability to drop some frames on the server and reduce the amount of bandwidth we're sending out to a client. And this is the interesting portion where we do simulcast. Because if everybody sets a... So if everybody has a 240p video, so I'm in my meeting like this, we've got multiple people on a 240p screen, and now someone joins and puts a pin on someone, and I make him full size. So I decide I have this really pretty colleague, I really want to look at him, but I don't need the other ones, but I don't want to impact the meeting, so I don't use the spotlight feature, I use the pin feature. So I take that specific video stream, pin it, and make it full size. Now, instead of us sending everybody a full HD video, what we do, we tell the original sender, hey, we've got an additional client. That additional client doesn't like your 1080p video. He wants you in full HD. Please send us an additional video stream in full HD. So now that additional video stream goes to the server. And that server now sends me his video in 1080p, while still sending the other videos in 180p to the other clients. That's what we have simulcast. It's what you get when you require various resolutions. We can also have, for instance, a Link 2010 client connecting to the meeting. That doesn't mean that everybody now gets VC1. No, just the Link 2010 client gets VC1. And the sender of the video gets requested, please also do VC1. This requires a different RTCP protocol, so we add an additional 15 kilobits. So what's the data sharing impact on video? Tiles get smaller, talked about this. What happens on a multi-screen, so a link room system, or people that split out a meeting? So I did it once to see if it works, and then again, this really interferes with Facebooking, so I don't do this. But if you have a link room system, this happens on by default. So at that point, you might have one participant that uses 240p while the other people use 180p. In that case, I get requested to send both 180p and 240p video. That was a lot of information, right? It's a lot of stuff. I do not want to be calculating network traffic based on this. So we sort of looked at a lot of customers, and we looked at our own, and we said, so how do people actually do that? Turned out to be fairly simple. We looked at what is the average consumer using, what's the average usage of Link. Yeah, video usage doubled. Way more people are using video when it's actually functional. It looks nice when you have the multi-video screen, the multiple people in a meeting. I like a meeting better if I can see people move. So we see people using more of it. P2P video calls, yeah, people are using it more. I don't know if Microsoft's really representative for that, because everybody in my team got a brand new head tracking webcam if we promised to use it in meetings. So I think more people have been bribed within Microsoft. That's why we looked at tap customers as well. And a bit of an uptake in video. But I think it's also the way people are working changes. More people work from home. So I think that has a larger impact than actually the technology. What we did look is look at what's the average conference? How does the average conference use video? So it turned out that the average conference had like 40 kilobits of traffic for video. And we got another peak when we go into the multi-view at about 130 to 200 kilobits. But below that, not so much. That's the one meeting that had a link room system, or the one meeting where someone decided to lock a spotlight, or to where people fiddled around just because it could be done. We see a very low bandwidth usage while using the video in meetings, because even if it's a small tile, it still adds dynamic to the meeting. You don't need everybody to be full 1080p in the meeting to still get the feeling of participation. So by sending, although, yeah, we can send up to 5 different video streams, it's very rare for that to happen. It happens in demos because we force it to. People don't mess around with Link as much as we thought it would. So on average, 1.6 video streams, mainly because of interop. Receive, average of 2.5 video streams. So 2 to 3 people in a meeting, that's average. Also, a lot of people apparently don't like webcams. They don't like video in meetings, depending on the country. So Nordic countries, this is very cultural. It's very interesting. I like difference in cultures. So Nordics, almost everybody uses a video. If every meeting I have with either Finland or Sweden or Norway, they use video. If I have meetings with people in Spain or meetings in Italy, they're like, oh no, I don't have a webcam. You're lying, it's in your laptop, I know you have. No, I don't use video, don't use video. It's a cultural thing. Changes per country, at least it does within Microsoft. And it's a company thing. So we documented that new model on TechNet. So we have a typical stream bandwidth and a maximum stream bandwidth. So yeah, if you look at the main video receive, yeah, we can go up to 8 Mbit. Completely true. Average 260. That's a big difference. Same for the typical stream bandwidth. So what should I use? When should I use typical? When should I use maximum? If you're calculating like a decent amount of users and you're calculating what's to be expected on the network, use typical. If a customer asks you what's the maximum amount of bandwidth Link could potentially use, explain what typical means, then tell them we could go up to 8 Mbit. There are some policies that you can implement to limit the maximum amount of bandwidth. Hardly ever needed. So we've given you something very nice, the Link 2013 bandwidth calculator. Yes, it's just a tool. We have a very nice Word document attached to that that talks to it, explains everything, explains all the values, helps you go through there. There's a DL, ucbwcalc@microsoft.com. It goes directly to Marius. So if you have questions, he will answer those questions because we make him. He updates this bandwidth calculator on a regular basis, works for 2010, 2013, has almost all use cases in it. So if you have questions, send them to the DL or ping me. I'd be happy to help as well. There are some special cases. So we thought we're clear. I'm going to confuse you again. So Link Room Systems, essentially Link 2013 client, but we have fantastic partners, and they have decided that it would be extremely cool to build a Link Room System with very high resolution monitors. It is extremely cool. So I've been to a demo with two 80-inch PPI Ultra HD screens. That was fantastic. And then he made a call. Then I thought, oh, this is going to cost so much bandwidth. This is going to be, I will get so many questions about this. Because every video was around 480p, and that had quite the impact on bandwidth usage. And then I saw the price tag, and I thought, oh, this is never going to happen. This is not my problem anymore. But we have to remember, looking at the Link Room Systems, by default, we suppress the UI, so we use only video. So sure, in the Link client, 240p, default, Link Room System, higher. Then again, they're not on every meeting, so the impact is limited, but still have to think about that. UI suppression, it does mean that if I use my Link Room System for a peer-to-peer call, it will be 1080p. It will be 720p, depending on what you bought. Yes, if you have a two-screen LRS without content sharing, you could use both screens for video. This is the portion where we say, use the bandwidth calculator and use your head. This is not really covered in the bandwidth calculator. Also, mobile clients. They use less bandwidth, but they still use bandwidth. They can consume content, they can send video, they can consume video, but they have different screen sizes, so that might cause additional video streams. There is no hardware acceleration on mobile clients except Windows Phone, because there's no access to the hardware accelerators in either Android or in the iPhone, which means that when placing video calls, the Windows Phone will get very hot because we use hardware acceleration, and the iPhone and the Android will get very hot because we use software acceleration. It always happens. So apart from people being able to toast bread in a very big conference, they will burn battery and they will have an impact on your bandwidth. We use different codecs. We don't use RT audio because it's too intensive for the mobile clients. We use Siren or G722 for peer-to-peer. We can use G711 for conference audio when it handles the PSTN. Yes, we use H.264 for video, but they're different. So we use different resolutions, different bandwidth than the desktop clients. So if you plan on deploying Link Mobile, include them in your bandwidth calculation. So, as a quick summary, we talked about QS. We talked about Link and QS. We talked about all the difficult stuff Link does, and then I made you kind of happy with the fact that you could ignore most of it, and you could just use typical bandwidth. So what we want to stress is, when you're talking about Link, talk about the underlying factors, such as the network as well. They make the difference between a great Link voice and Link video implementation and a very poor one. No matter how well you deploy Link, if the network sucks, your Link deployment will suck. So I included some references as well. So we have all the related content, both here and on TechNet. And that's that. That's it from my side. So please do your evaluations. Thank you for being here. I hope if you go to other sessions, I hope you have a nice day. And that's it for me. Come on. Just come up.